Genesis chapter 9, we are, I try to put announcements on Facebook about the upcoming Bible study, just for people to be a reminder, or pique some interest, or whatever the case may be. And the one for this one was describing the fact that there's going to be a new arrangement, a new dispensation. What we see in Genesis chapter 9 is a great change dispensationally. It is a profound change in many ways on things that we're going to see. And so really, when it comes to Genesis chapter 9, it's really hard for the non-dispensational person to deny dispensationalism. I mean, because at the heart of dispensationalism, all kinds of false labels might be spread regarding dispensationalism, but really at the heart of dispensationalism isn't that God changes. It's that God changes how he deals with mankind. And there's no arguing that what is taking place here is a change in how God is dealing with mankind from what he was doing before. Many would suggest that there are seven different dispensations. And so if that is the case, if that's how you look at scripture, it's seven different dispensations, then this would be probably the third one for you. The dispensation of innocence, the dispensation of conscience, meaning that in innocence, God gave these expectations to Adam and Eve. They failed. They didn't live up to them. Something changed. And they then moved into the dispensation of conscience. And man was to rule himself by his conscience. He knew right from wrong, and yet he still chose to do wrong, which is going to be the theme of all of mankind. I don't care what the situation is, whether it was in perfect, the perfect situation in the garden where there was no sin, man chose to do wrong. Whether it's under conscience, when man still has God, and you still have prophets, under that time period, man still chose to do what is wrong. God even said that from thy youth, every imagination of man is evil continually. And so God understands, he acknowledges, and he announces to man that, look, everything that you think about is evil. And so now we move into what many would call as the dispensation of human government. And the reason why it's called that is obviously because what we see here is when we get into verses 6 and 7 in particular, we see God establishing the fact that when man kills another man, by man, his life shall be taken. And as we get into that, we'll talk about it then. Up until this point, God had never authorized man to take another man's life, even for, you know, penalty of murder. There was never granted that permission. And so this chapter, Genesis chapter 9, like I said, it's going to mark a significant change. And we talked about the government. What about even talking about the food situation? Now man gets to eat meat. He gets to have Southern barbecue.
With sauce?
Hey, that might have been one of the first things I would have invented afterwards, is sauce. Good barbecue sauce. Now, I've joked many times that in heaven we must be able to eat meat because it wouldn't be heaven if you could. Now, that is a joke. Because I think what we see here is in the perfect design, God created man as vegetarians. And we talked last week, we don't know, it's speculation that that animals didn't eat other animals before the flood. We know that they weren't supposed to whenever God in Genesis chapter 1, verses 29 and 30, I think it's 29:30. The instruction was man only to eat of the herbs and animals to do the same. Well, we see that man becomes violent. There's all kinds of murders. And I would personally suspect, as we talked about last week, that when you have these people who were probably committing all kinds of murders, they probably weren't too concerned about the idea, well, but God said we can't eat sheep. They probably didn't care about what God had to say about what they could eat. So I wouldn't suspect this is the first time man eats meat. This is the first time man is authorized by God to eat meat. We don't know. And it really doesn't matter. But we do know that up to this point, God did not want man to eat meat. And I would suspect that he didn't want animals to eat meat until this point. And so that is another one of the huge changes that takes place. Many today don't eat meat for different reasons, and that's fine. But what we're going to see here in Genesis chapter 9 is God gives it to man. He allows man to have meat. And so it's not wrong to eat meat, like some might say. Some, again, are vegetarian, and they do so because they choose to be, and there's absolutely nothing wrong with that. But if you eat meat, you shouldn't feel compelled like you're doing something wrong. God gave it to man to eat, and that is just the way it is. And for some, that's hard to accept. For some, it's very hard to accept the idea of eating an animal. And if that is the case, then, hey, don't. That's fine. All right. So again, to kind of elaborate what's going on here in Genesis chapter 9 is we're going to see Noah and his sons come off the boat, and we're going to see God reestablish with man man's right to rule over the earth. We talked about the fact that whenever Noah comes off of this boat, it's a drastically different world. It's not the same world that he would have seen beforehand. But the fact of the matter is man is still going to rule over the world. Turn with me to the book of Psalms, chapter 115. And this verse is true today. This verse is true for Noah when Noah comes off the ark. Psalm chapter 115, verse 16. As the heaven, even the heavens are the Lord's, but the earth hath he given to the children of men. And so man has been given the earth. And now it's great to go into a theological study on that. Man has been given the earth. Man is the one who sinned and caused the problems we have. And it's because of one man that sinned the earth. And it had to be by one man to reclaim it, didn't it? That gets into some really cool studies in itself, that it had to be a human to come take it back. Man is given this earth. Again, whenever Noah comes off of the ark, it's going to be an earth that probably doesn't look like the most beautiful earth. It's a fallen world, but it's still more than man deserves. So think about it like this. When Noah comes off of the ark and he sees the earth, and the earth is given to man again to have dominion over it, it's still more than what man deserves. Man doesn't deserve even this. So when we talk about the blessings that we have, the fact that we have the earth for us to rule, for us to reign, we don't have to worry about running out of things. We don't have to worry about destroying the earth. That in itself is more than what we deserve. So, all right. Genesis chapter 9, verse 1. And God blessed Noah and his sons and said unto them, be fruitful and multiply and replenish the earth. And again, to end chapter 8, God made the promise that summer and winter and day and night shall not cease. And so that's a promise that God gives to man. And here we see a blessing that God gives to Noah. And understand with this, before we move on a verse that we could simply just move past really easy. The world thinks that our God, did you see that story that just came out today about that singer for that Christian rock band who says now he doesn't believe in God? Did you see that story? And he said that, I'm not saying that there isn't a God, but I'm saying he's not the God that I've been told about, which is sad. because many in the world are told or understand the wrong kind of God. The God that we have is a God who wishes for good for mankind, who wishes for prosperity for mankind. And the first thing that God does whenever a Noah comes off of the ark is to bless him. That's the first thing he does, is he gives man a blessing. And so he's issuing this idea. He wants good things. He always wants good for mankind. He always has gracious intentions for mankind. The world, again, sees a God that doesn't see that. But the fact of the matter is all through these different times, he's trying to get man to want good when he himself does. Look at Jeremiah chapter 29. Jeremiah chapter 29, verse 11. Valerie used to teach Sunday school at the church, and this is one of the verses I know that she used to teach the kids when they were young. And why is it? It's because the verse talks about God's desire for good for mankind. Yes, Jeremiah was a prophet of Israel. Yes, this book is written to Israel. But don't think that it's not true for mankind. Jeremiah 29:11 says, "For I know the thoughts that I think toward you, saith the Lord. Thoughts of peace and not of evil, to give you an expected end." In other words, God has good thoughts towards man. I don't think that he ever wants harm for mankind. And as we're going to see, I think that part of the reason for the expectation of man taking the life of other man is because he wants good things for man, which sounds a little bit ironic, but it's still true. Look at the book of Lamentations. Lamentations chapter 3. Lamentations chapter 3. A book that we don't go to very often. Here we have a verse that I like to use. Talks about God's mercies. Lamentations chapter 3. Look at verse 22. "It is of the Lord's mercies that we are not consumed, because his compassions fail not. They are new every morning." Well, what's new every morning? His compassions and his mercies. You ever stop to think that every single day that you have, every single day that you wake up, isn't just a matter of, "Whew, I woke up again." Every single day you can count on the fact that God is merciful, that he's gracious, and it abounds to us all. And we're going to see, as God makes a covenant with Noah, that we can understand that is a part of that reason, is because God makes a covenant with Noah, his sons, all the animals, and for all of the seed afterwards, which includes us. And that is that he is going to be merciful, that he's going to be gracious. He's still going to deal with sin. But God's mercies are true. They're renewed every single day. And I think that the world needs to know that this God that we serve, so many people think of the God of the Old Testament as a God who, boy, look at what he did. You know, he's going and telling Israel to go in and kill all these people and do all this kind of stuff. And they think that he's not a God of mercy, not a God of love. Right here in verse 1 of chapter 9, we see God is blessing Noah. And what does he say? "Be fruitful and multiply, replenish the earth." Now, if you're using the King James Bible and it says replenish, understand that just like in Genesis 1, at the time that this was written, replenish meant fill. It meant fill. It didn't mean refill the earth. Unfortunately, there are many commentaries and commentators, especially over the years, that suggest that This is evidence that there was, like we talked about in Genesis 1, there was a group of people before Adam. That's not the case at all. Here, Noah is told to go fill the earth. And the other thing to understand from this verse is the instruction isn't to go fill a certain area of the earth. It's to go fill the earth. And we're going to see that God intends for that whenever we get to the Tower of Babel. One of the things, that, as we're going to see here, is that God puts the fear of animal, or fear of man, in animal. And one of the reasons I would suggest to you, one of the reasons for that is to cause man to spread out in the earth. Whenever animals are afraid of man, you're going to have to migrate in different areas to go find those animals, especially if you're going to be able to eat them now. And so God's intention was for man to have dominion over the earth and to go fill it, not to sit there and come together as one group and resource your, bring together your resources. I think that most of us would agree that it's not a coincidence that usually you find the most crime and most unfortunate situations where more people congregate together. That's not a new thing. I think that's always been a thing. I think that whenever man tends to be with his family and is able to have his relationship with God and have less people around, I think it tends to be a good thing. So God wants man to fill the earth, to be fruitful. And the other thing I would tell you about fruitful, this idea is beyond the idea of just bearing fruit. In other words, to reproduce. I think that the Bible is often gives us the understanding that to be fruitful is to also, I guess the better way to put it is, many people can have children, but that's not necessarily being fruitful. How you go about having children, what you do with your children, what you teach them, what you educate them on, those types of things, that's the true essence of being fruitful. This isn't just about having babies. This is about being producing fruit. It's to grow, but also to do more with it. So verse 2, Genesis chapter 9, verse 2, it says, "And the fear of you and the dread of you shall be upon every beast of the earth, and upon every fowl of the air, and upon all that moveth upon the earth, and upon all the fishes of the sea, into your hand are they delivered." So here we see that this fear, God is going to put fear for mankind from the animals. There's literally going to be a dread. Now, there's no indication from Scripture that was the case beforehand. There's no indication really one way or the other. Again, some people would teach that animals didn't fear man at all. Because, look, the animals just came right up to Noah in the boat. Well, God sent the animals. And again, like I said, I would be surprised that people weren't hunting animals before this point and killing them. We already know that they were sacrificing, but those would have been most likely animals that they had themselves tamed and kept. So, but here now there's going to be dread. And here we get this statement, "Into your hand are they delivered." This statement, I think, And again, thoughts and comments on it. It's not just into your hand are they delivered for food, but think about the greater aspect of what this is talking about. You have Noah, Shem, Ham, and Japheth. Into your hand are these animals. You have dominion over them. So it's not just fear. Like I said, we talked about vegetarians, those who don't like to harm animals. Well, I'm not a vegetarian, but I sure don't like to mistreat animals. We are there to have dominion over these animals, but that means they're also supposed to be under our protection, which means we shouldn't be abusing animals. Into our hand are they delivered. Here God is saying, the earth is yours, subdue it, fill it, have dominion over it. These animals are in your hands, mankind. It's for you to deal with. And so it's not just a matter of, you get to eat them and you get to abuse them or anything like that. It's there for us to protect. God doesn't put animals on the same level as humans. And to do so is very wrong. Matter of fact, there's religions that do that. We don't ever want to put animal. But at the same time, God does acknowledge that in animal is life. And life is precious. And so to abuse animals is wrong. And so you can tease them. I tease our cat. So I tease our cat. So what's that? They do. She likes to lay on the floor, and I'll go up, and she'll be laying there, and I'll take my toe, and I'll tickle the pad of her foot, and she just jerks her foot because she gets her foot gets tickled. And Val asks me, which she's probably watching right now, she says, "Why are you so mean to that cat?" I said, "I'm not mean. I'm just playing." But here we see, I think, that animals are delivered into the hand of man. Man does have power. He has rightful authority. Again, we see this. And they're delivered. I think that this fear that's mentioned here is going to cause animals to stay away from man. We see that today wherever you go. Most animals, even if you're out camping. I mean, there's people that go camping when they know there's bears out there. Now, if I know there's bears out there, I'm going to have my shotgun. But there's people out there, and the animals will generally stay away from us. That's why lions and animals don't really come into the city too much. Again, if they're pressed for food or whatever, they might do it. But generally speaking, the animals move away from mankind, and man has to follow after the animals to be able to find sources of food. So, like I said, under innocence, man was to rule these animals as well, but they weren't to eat them. There was no reason, really, other than a sacrifice situation, there was no reason for a man to kill an animal. And so there was this idea of ruling under innocence for man to rule under love, but fallen man is going to rule by fear, which is a totally different situation that we're going to see right now. This is one of the dispensational changes that are taking place. Any comments or questions on that? Okay. Moving right along. Verse 3. Every moving thing that lives shall be meat for you. Even as the green herb have I given you all things, but flesh with the life thereof, which is the blood thereof, shall you not eat. And so here we get the authorization, the okay, so to speak, to eat meat. Before this, I would expect that Noah probably never ate meat in his life. I don't think that Noah was perfect in the sense that he had never sinned. I seriously doubt he could live 600 years and have never sinned. But at the same time, he walked with God, so I would bet that he understood that he was not supposed to eat meat, so he probably never did. And at this point, again, now he's authorized to do so. But we have this caveat that God gives. There's this exception, and that is that you're not going to eat the flesh that has the life in it. And this is interesting because this expectation we see stays even with Israel. Now, their idea of being able to eat meat gets dwindled down further, where you can only eat clean animals, you can't eat unclean animals. But still, the idea of eating animals with the blood in it was, not allowed. It was very, very bad to be doing so. And I think with this, we see that when animals kill other animals, they don't kill it in a merciful way, do they? No, they generally start to eat it alive. There's an expectation on man that you don't do that. The expectation on man is that you slay the animal, you kill the animal, you drain the blood of it, and then you cook it and eat it. In other words, there's an aspect that it's probably a much more merciful way of killing an animal. People think today, and maybe rightfully so, when how cows are killed, that may be an unmerciful way. You compare that to the way an animal would eat an animal, and the way man is supposed to do it is a much more merciful way. And so I would suggest to you the idea of how you kill an animal in itself is supposed to show an act of mercy, because killing an animal, again, is still killing life. An animal, a life is a life. An animal life isn't as important as a man's life, but it's still taking a life. And so, but just out of reminder, Genesis 1, if you want to go there, verses 29 and 30, we see God giving the instruction to Adam for Adam and Eve, what they can. Genesis chapter 1:29 says, "And God said, Behold, I have given you every herb bearing seed, which is upon the face of the earth, and every tree in the which is the fruit of the tree yielding seed, to you it shall be for meat. And every beast of the earth, and every fowl of the air, and everything that creeps on the earth, wherein there is life, I have given every green herb for meat." And it was so. And so, and even here, to be honest with you, there's restrictions. Notice the word there in verse 29, "Behold, I have given you every herb bearing seed." That means that they still weren't supposed to eat the herbs that didn't bear seed. Only the ones that did bear seed, which is interesting, because either Adam has perfect knowledge at this point, or he's got to go figure it out. You know any herbs that don't bear seeds? Ferns, moss, those are green herbs that don't bear seeds. That's two of them. There's other ones, but those don't bear seed. And so assuming moss was around at that time or ferns were around at that time, that would have not been acceptable for Adam to eat. And so there were restrictions, but again, they couldn't have meat then. And now here we see that you can have meat, but it cannot have its blood. Again, that was a huge issue. Turn to Leviticus under Israel. And we see that well into Paul's ministry, too, as we'll look at Leviticus chapter 17. Look at verse 13. This was a command to Israel in how they governed the land of Israel, meaning whether it was for the people of Israel and the strangers who were in Israel. So Leviticus chapter 17, verse 13, it says, "And whatsoever man there be of the children of Israel or of the strangers that sojourn among you, which hunteth and catcheth any beast or fowl that may be eaten, he shall even pour out the blood thereof and cover it with dust." Notice this. So when you pour out the blood, God wants you to actually cover that blood. Now, I'm sure that science today would tell us that there's practical reasons for it. And maybe that's the reason why God would institute it. But still, we see that there's an expectation for man to drain the animal, to cover that blood. Verse 14, "For it," talking about the blood, "for it is the life of all flesh. The blood of it is for the life thereof. Therefore, I said unto the children of Israel, you shall eat the blood of no manner of flesh. For the life of the flesh is in the blood thereof. Whosoever eateth it shall be cut off." And so this ends up staying in place. Look at chapter 3 of Leviticus, verse 17. Here we see, and I think we've talked about this once before, that Israel was even restricted from eating fat. Verse 17, "It shall be a perpetual statute for your generations throughout all your dwellings, that you eat neither fat nor blood." Blood was highly restricted. And turn to Acts 15. If you're familiar with the book of Acts, obviously we have the history of the transition from God dealing with the nation of Israel to dealing with the Gentiles, and not so much just the Gentiles as much as setting aside Israel. The book of Acts is the story of the setting aside of Israel. Paul has to go to Jerusalem and talk with the Jews there, the 12 apostles and the church there, the group there. And what is the requirement that the 12 apostles give for the Gentiles, which Paul later basically says, you don't have to worry about that either. But what is the restriction that they have? Well, we see a few things here. Look at verse 20 of Acts 15. Again, just above this, what you see is that Paul expresses to them what's going on. The question is of circumcision, and they decide, nope, Gentiles need to be circumcised, and they issue these expectations for Gentiles. So that's the situation. Verse 20, but we write unto them that they abstain from pollutions of idols and from fornication and from things strangled and from blood. You see, Israel even had restrictions on how you could kill an animal. In other words, you couldn't eat animals that were killed a certain way. Again, that's on top of what was built on here in Genesis chapter 9. And so here we see that the apostles in Jerusalem wanting the Gentiles to have these expectations. And so when it says from blood, it's not that they're expecting Gentiles to be walking around with a pitcher full of blood. It's talking specifically really about eating animals that still has the life therein of it. It's either still alive or hasn't been killed and the blood drained. So that's what this is really, really referring to. And we know today, matter of fact, just go there since we're on the subject. What's Paul say for us today in 1 Timothy chapter 4? We don't have to worry about any of those things. 1 Timothy chapter 4, verse 4, we can see, I still think that it's good that we don't eat animals that still have the blood in them. I think that you should kill an animal mercifully, and I think that you should only eat animals that are dead, and I think that you should cook your food. So I think that it's still good for us not to eat that. But here we see Paul saying, for every creature of God is good, and nothing to be refused if it be received with thanksgiving. So we see, again, a dispensational change. Here in Genesis chapter 9, Noah is basically said that you can eat all these animals. There's no restrictions. Just don't eat them if they have the blood in them. Then God institutes change with Israel. Then after that, he institutes another change for us. And so we go back to like the situation here with Noah in Genesis chapter 9. And so for those who want to suggest that there aren't dispensational changes, oftentimes they say that in regards to salvation. I was talking with somebody earlier about salvation and the tribulation, and they're trying to apply our eternal salvation to Jews. And so people want to reject dispensational changes where it's convenient, but few will actually argue that this is dispensationally change that's going on. And so we want to approach the scriptures rightly. We want to rightly divide the scriptures and understand that God has had different instructions at different times. And that's a huge situation of what's going on here in Genesis chapter 9. All right, back to Genesis chapter 9. We saw in verses 3 and 4 that you can eat any of the animals. But you need to take the precaution of making sure that you don't eat the blood thereof. In verse 5, and surely your blood of your lives will I require. At the hand of every beast will I require it, and at the hand of man, and at the hand of every man's brother will I require the life of a man. You think that last part is maybe a reference to Cain? It's interesting that he throws that in there. And so here we see that God is now, verse 6, whoever sheds man's blood, by man shall his blood be shed. For in the image of God made he man. And so here we see what many, myself included, would suggest is human government being instituted. And I believe that's what's going on here. There are those who deny that this is the beginning of human government, and they'll take you back to Genesis. Let's go there, Genesis 1. Let's just deal with that. Verse 1, verse 26. Genesis 1:26, and said, and God said, let us make man in our image, after our likeness, and let them have dominion over the fish of the sea, and over the fowl of the air, and over the cattle, and over all the earth, and every creeping thing that creepeth on the earth. And some will say, see, that Genesis 9 isn't the beginning of human government. We have it here in Genesis 1. And I would differ with that belief system. I think what we have here now is there's a difference between us having a dominion. We're in charge of the land. We're in charge of all the animals. And now we have God saying specifically that when someone takes a man's life, you will take his life. There's a difference between that situation. Until this point, God never authorized anyone to take another person's life. And now we see that God is creating a human government system. And we know that Adam lived for a long time, but I don't see any justification that Adam was going to be able to form some government. And they were going to have the right to take another man's life. You don't see that in the scripture. You can see that they had dominion. They were the rulers over the animals. But again, that is not human government as we understand it. What we're seeing here, to me, in my opinion, is a human government situation. And that gets built upon later through Israel. And as we're going to see, that the reason why I think God institutes this is one of a few different reasons, but specifically because life is precious. We just got done seeing his requirement when it came to animals. And now he's teaching the lesson that if you're going to take a man's life, no longer is it going to just be waiting for some day to come. Judgment is to come upon you for doing so. And it's to come swiftly, and it's to come justly, but it is to come. And there is no getting around it. The expectation here is verse 6, whoever sheds man's blood, by man shall his blood be shed, for in the image of God he made man. It is a consistent approach that God has had since this time. It is really the authorization, like I said, and it's not even just the authorization. As we see God's expectation here, if you notice the wording here, it's not, well, you can take his life, is it? No, I will require it, is what he says. You are now my instrument of justice in this world. I am the head. You are now my instrument on the earth, and you are to take the life of someone who takes the life of man. And we see again further, like I said, understanding of the expectation. Many people today don't, well, before I get there, I don't want to get there yet. I'm getting ahead of myself. Look at Exodus chapter 21. Look at some of the things that God builds upon this with the nation of Israel. Exodus 21:12. Again, it helps us to understand the mind of God. Exodus chapter 21, look at verse 12. Exodus 21:12 says, he that smites a man so that he die shall be surely put to death. Jump down to verse 28. If an ox gore a man or a woman that he die, then the ox shall be put to death, shall be stoned, and his flesh shall not be eaten. But the owner of the ox shall not be. That's if you got a King James, shall be quit. He's not going to be held accountable for that. Verse 29, but if the ox were known to push with his horn in times past, in other words, be aggressive, and it hath been testified to his owner, and he hath not kept him in, but that he hath killed a man or a woman, the ox shall be stoned, and his owner also shall be put to death. What is that telling us? God's saying life is precious. Man, be responsible. And he's saying, as government goes, if somebody is not reverent to the life of man, and the reason for it is because, as Genesis 9, we just got that reading, he is made in God's image. If you don't reverence that, then there's a penalty to pay, and it's going to be paid swiftly. So much so that if a man has a dog, And we see this today with people with their dogs. Somebody has a dog. They know that people have already filed complaints. This dog's got out. It's already attacked people. And under the law, I'm not saying today that it should happen, but under the law in Israel, if that dog got out and killed somebody, guess what was supposed to happen to that person?
He dies too.
Right. That's how. Now, does that show that God doesn't sanctify life, or does it show the exact opposite? It shows the opposite. It shows how much he wants us to understand how precious life is. See, man, they looks, well, God doesn't think life is precious. He just got done killing the whole planet. He got done killing the whole planet because man was filled with violence. Not because he was filled with violence, but because man was filled with violence. And here he's instituting rules and regulations and instructions in Genesis. And we see really the heart here. And are you familiar with the term progressive revelation? If you're not, there's a message on the website that I taught. And I'm sure you can find many other teachers who can do a better job than I on it. Progressive revelation is the idea that as time has gone by, the information has progressed, which is different than progressive understanding. And so we understand that as time goes by, God has revealed more and more information. None of it ever contradicts his character, who he is. So you won't find something that contradicts who he is, but you will find that he gives more information. So here we have more information about how God sees life, that it's precious to him. So much so that if you have animals, you better take safeguards and respect the life around you and make sure that those things don't happen. Look at Numbers chapter 35. You want to know the extent of God's belief on how punishment should be for murderers? This is a good passage. Numbers chapter 35. Verse 31. Moreover, you shall take no satisfaction. In other words, don't take a bribe. Don't take any form of compensation for the life of a murderer, which is guilty of death, but he shall surely be put to death. So in other words, what this is saying is don't take any compensation for somebody who's a murderer, and don't put him to death. He's to be put to death. You know, you can't. I mean, we today, one of the problems I have with our justice system today is we see prosecuting attorneys. They'll have somebody who's being charged with first degree murder, and they'll let that person do a plea deal.
Life in prison.
And we'll get into the death penalty in a minute. The whole idea of the death penalty. But understand, God's heart's desire is if a person takes the life of somebody, you don't take something from them. I don't even care if it means you have to spend less money on a trial. I don't care what it is. You don't take something from them, even a plea deal, and then not put them to death. That's God's position. You don't profit on it, and he ends it by saying he shall surely be put to death. That's God's heart's desire on the situation. And so why? It's not because killing people is an acceptable thing. It's because it's meant to cause people to not do it. I can tell you right now, most people will plead guilty as soon as they find out that the state's going to try and charge them with the death penalty. Don't tell me the death penalty doesn't work. Because as soon as somebody finds out that they're going to be charged with the death penalty, they're ready to say, I'll take the deal.
Yeah.
Now, if we actually exacted judgment the way it was supposed to be done, I would suspect we would have a lot less problems than what we do. Look at Deuteronomy chapter 21. Deuteronomy chapter 21. Let's start... Now, this is a really interesting passage. And again, I can say that for everything, right? Deuteronomy chapter 21. What we see here before we start reading it is a scenario that if if you find somebody out in the wilderness, and again, in their situation, you might have a tribe who's in one part of the land and then another tribe here. And so you'd have these vast distances or whatever. And here we're dealing with a situation that if you find a dead person and you don't know what happened here, you don't even know where he belongs to. If you find him, you're going to measure the distance to the closest town. And you're going to get those priests to come and swear an oath that they didn't have anything to do with it. And they're going to sacrifice an animal. And they're going to swear an oath to God saying that the blood of this person is not upon us. Now, to us, that sounds crazy. But again, it's showing the intensity of respecting life and don't taking life. So let's read what happens here. Deuteronomy chapter 21. Let's run to verse 1. If one be found slain in the land which the Lord thy God giveth thee to possess it, lying in the field, and it be not known who hath slain him, then thy elders and thy judges shall come forth, and they shall measure unto the cities which are round about him that is slain. And it shall be that the city which is next unto the slain man, so in other words, the closest one, even the elders of that city shall take a heifer which has not been wrought with and which had not drawn the yoke. In other words, don't bring us your old retired animal here. You're going to bring us one of the good of your animal, and you're going to do this, is what God said. And the elders of that city shall bring down the heifer unto a rough valley, which is neither earned nor eared or sown, and shall strike off the heifer's neck there in the valley. And the priests and the sons of Levi shall come near, for them the Lord thy God hath chosen to minister unto him and to bless in the name of the Lord. And by their word shall every controversy and every stroke be tried. And all the elders of that city that are next to the slain man shall wash their hands over the heifer that is beheaded in the valley. And they shall answer and say, our hands have not shed this blood, neither have our eyes seen it. Be merciful, O Lord, unto thy people, Israel, whom thou hast redeemed, and lay not innocent blood unto thy people of Israel's charge, and the blood shall be forgiven them. And so, verse 9, so shalt thou put away the guilt of innocent blood from among you, when thou shalt do that which is right in the sight of the Lord. In other words, God doesn't want anyone's life to be taken for granted. Even if you find a life that you don't know happened, we're going to make a big deal out of this. God said, we're going to make a big deal about this. And he says, I want somebody to give an assessment of, we're not guilty of this. Their blood, innocent blood, not be upon me. And taking the life of innocent blood, like I said, is one of the most egregious things a person can do, which is why God requires that person's life in exchange. We talked about in my message before about the trial of Jesus and how awful that was. And you know, just the idea of bearing false witness against somebody, which leads to them they don't even have to be put to death. If you come and bear false witness against somebody who's on trial for their life, and even if it doesn't succeed, you're still supposed to get put to death according to law. That's how serious it is. And so we have to understand how serious life is, and that better impact us when it comes to things like abortion, that better impact us when it comes to all manner of things. Does that mean that God does not allow the death penalty today? Did God institute the death penalty? In my opinion, he did institute the death penalty. And I am in favor of the death penalty today. I'm in favor of it never having to be used. I'm totally in favor of that. Now, the one thing I will say in regards to the death penalty today, if I was to be convinced of any reason not to use the death penalty today, it surely isn't because God isn't for it. You will not win that argument. But what you can argue from is that the standards for finding somebody guilty today are not the same as they were then. God expected, he expected a person to be accountable for the charge of murder. In other words, there had to be a witness. We today, we love our detective shows and people love their DNA. And I'll be honest with you. I'm sure DNA proves every bit of what they say it does. But it still fails to take into account that God isn't necessarily looking for the complete proof. He's looking for someone to be accountable. In other words, if there's somebody who's going to, if there's somebody who's going to give testimony that somebody did it, then they need to stand up and give testimony that they know that they did it. And there's going to be an accountability. There's got to be an accountability part. So we'll stop there. But any questions on the death penalty aspect? Because you may have thought, and I always encourage people, when you're trying to figure out right and wrong, don't start with, well, this is what I feel. That's the worst way to try to figure out right and wrong. Scripture tells us the heart is deceitful and desperately wicked. You may think that you're merciful when, in fact, you're actually not being merciful. What you're subscribing to is going to create more anarchy and more problems. So, yeah. No comments?
I have a comment.
Yeah.
Used to be, if somebody was found guilty of murder, the penalty was right then.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't drag on for 20 years.
Yeah.
Well, you know. But then, of course, you have people that have been wrongly convicted mm-hmm. because somebody lied.
Mm-hmm.
So what do you do?
Well, to me, I think we go to, even though we're not under the law, we still go back to a biblical model. I wish that I would be called more often as a juror. And the reason for that is not because I think I'm so smart. It's because I try to approach it humbly. What is it that, what's God's standard? Well, God's standard really comes down to the fact of, is the person actually guilty? It's not to me about, is he mostly guilty? And the other thing I would tell you is that when we get back to the way it's supposed to be, in other words, you mentioned the idea of people coming in and lying. Well, guess what you should do to those people?
Kill them.
Yeah.
They should get the same treatment.
And they should be warned ahead of time. Look, are you sure you want to come forward and say this person's guilty? Because if you're found out later to be lying, guess what's going to happen? You probably get a lot more people who are going to step back and say, well, wait a minute, I'm not. And this is, again, the biblical way is never going to produce a perfect system. Why? Because man's still doing it. The only way you're going to have a perfect system is if whenever God's doing it. And that's what's going to happen during the thousand-year reign. He's going to rule and reign with a rod of iron. He's going to reign in perfect justice, which means guess what? Nobody's going to be able to come and say, Lord, they said I did this, but I didn't. And he's going to say, well, I wonder if he did it or not. No, he's going to know.
You did do it.
And so what we do is we go back to the most biblical model, the most biblical way that we can. And to me, I know that most people don't want to rely on witnesses. To me, that's the biblical model. But we are in such a situation now that it's so messed up. Like you said, I mean, to me, the idea of a quick execution is merciful. Somebody knows that for 20 years or in 10 years that they're going to die. To me, that's inhumane. Yeah. You know, now, obviously, if they've got appeals they want to go through and they think they might get out of it. But how many times does that happen? You know, all it does is extend their life and misery and all that kind of a thing. So but we'll retouch a little bit on this next week. And we'll, again, look at Romans chapter 13. Go read Romans 13, because as it relates to human government, Romans 13 is very much for us today. And I wish more people understood Romans 13. So.
All right.
All right. Very good.